It's going down, and you're invited for what they selling. We ain't buying. There is no running, there is no hiding. There's only fighting or dying. It's going down, and you're invited for what they selling. We ain't buying. There is no running, there is no hiding. There's only fighting or dying.
It's Going Down is a digital community center from anarchist, anti-fascist, autonomous, anti-capitalist, and anti-colonial movements. Our mission is to provide an autonomous and resilient platform to publicize and promote revolutionary theory and action.
Go to itsgoingdown.org for daily updates. Check out our online store for ways to donate and rate and follow us on iTunes if you like this podcast. We're joined here once again with Michael, a teacher in West Virginia. Just to get us started, looking back over the past year, what's happened since the first big strike?
Well, a lot's happened actually since we went back last March, and I'll try to give you like a very rough overview of what the organizing has looked like over the past year. So after the strike ended last year, in early March, we wrapped up the strike. We felt like we had won our concession. We won the 5% raise and the promise that there would be a fix to our health insurance plan. And as soon as we were wrapping up our strike, people from Oklahoma and Arizona started reaching out to us and were interested in what we had done. And so we acted as sort of like agitators to help let others know, you know, this is how we were able to organize so quickly. This is how we tried to focus on very specific issues that people who might otherwise be non-politicized as union members could join in and take an active role in. And so we had several conversations and conference calls with folks in Oklahoma before their walkout and help them try to, you know, do what they could to get organized very quickly. And we were in contact with some of the lead organizers in Arizona who were equally, who were also feeling like there was no hope there. Charters were expanding. The pay for teachers in Arizona was stagnant, but they also felt like, well, if, you know, people in West Virginia can do it, then we can do it in Arizona too. And so, in Oklahoma, Kentucky, and Arizona, the states that had major statewide actions that were, you know, prolonged more than a single day, actually used a lot of our strategy that we used in West Virginia. They created their secret social media pages. They used them to do both online and on the ground organizing. So they would talk with their coworkers, get them signed up on this page. And when people would be sitting in the teacher's lounge or something, just scrolling through Facebook, they could, you know, just see what was going on across the state. It helped everyone get politicized very quickly in all those, in every other case as well. And very quickly they saw as well that you can build something that is semi-independent from your business union and allow folks to kind of become radicalized through it and take a more active role in their union because of it. But in the different states that happened after West Virginia, we saw like a varying degree of success and failure. In Oklahoma, for example, there was a struggle between the OEA, the Oklahoma Education Association, and some of the independent organizers like Larry Cagle, who were very upset at OEA for not really doing as much and just being a lobbying effort or lobbying organization. And because there was such infighting and fracturing and more of a division there, it took Oklahoma educators longer after their strike to kind of build that momentum back again and start reorganizing. Kentucky, their issue was, just like everywhere else, their unions didn't want to go on strike, but the members did. They unfortunately had to go on strike when a lot of counties were on spring break. And so between that issue and trying to figure out how they could maintain these massive lines of communication across 120 counties, they had a few day walkout, went back, and then went out again a few of the counties when their pension bill was up for vote. Their biggest issue that we've noticed was there was a bigger divide in Kentucky between the urban areas and the more rural parts of Kentucky. And we figured eventually when the strike wave hit, states like that had a more stark divide, what would that look like? And Kentucky was sort of the flashpoint of what does that organizing look like? And it unfortunately did kind of break down on racial lines there that forced organizers who were outside of Louisville, who weren't involved in organizing there, to see the strike as, we have to fight for these issues first, the pension first, then every other issue second. And in Arizona, their organizing, I think, was probably one of the more effective ones that allowed them to, after the strike, to maintain lines of communication with their key organizers and keep building this power after the walkouts. So what we were trying to do in West Virginia was every time there'd be fuss in another state, we would try to act as agitators to try to stoke those flames and provide whatever organizational structure we could. And, we'd offer solidarity pictures, signs of support, whatever we could, to show that they could do this too. Well, over the summer, we had several conversations with folks who were kind of the ones who were like the black sheep of the unions and were kind of the more militant ones during the walkouts, the ones who said we shouldn't go back, who kind of agitated for the Wildcats. And we had a meeting in July, and we brought together all these different teacher union members from across the country who are involved in their different states. We brought in folks from Arizona, Oklahoma, Kentucky, Massachusetts, everywhere, to West Virginia. And we said, like, what does this look like going forward? How are we going to go back to our states and try to rebuild that power? And in West Virginia, what we felt was most effective was creating a caucus. So in September, what we did was we actually launched our rank and file caucus called West Virginia United as sort of an homage to the 55 United strike. And we wanted to use this caucus as a way to continue to build that power after the strikes happened, but we didn't want to just fall into the trap of, going into our unions, telling them what they needed to do, and then becoming like just another political lobbying arm. And we had some discussions around election time, like, do we become a caucus that brings folks together and then issues endorsements or canvasses for candidates? Or are we going to try to maintain our independence from that structure? And ultimately, we decided we wouldn't get involved. We would try to remain independent. After the election, some folks seemed very angry and upset about the fact that they felt even if we were going to be independent, some of the people who helped us along during the strike should have done better. But regardless of that, we use the caucus, and we're using the caucus now as a way to continue to try to get teachers and service personnel who felt disconnected from their union, who felt like there wasn't enough support in their school to help them organize, to help them figure out what their issues are, how do they fight against it, whether it's an abusive administrator, a superintendent or board of education that's not great, but especially fighting against our state legislature. And luckily, we had done enough of this organizing that by February, you know, this month, we were able to help further the agitation along that the unions were forced to call a 2-day walkout against this omnibus bill.
Do you still feel that the secret Facebook groups were an integral part of launching the broader organizing?
I think it definitely helps to act as a catalyst for future organizing. The reason why I think it's at least a helpful tool when starting out with these statewide actions is, you don't usually know if you're just someone who goes to work every day, as a teacher or bus driver or cook or anything in a school system, usually you don't even really have time to sit down and like chat with your coworkers about what's going on outside of your school. And typically anything that's going on in your school is just how it affects your job in the immediate right here and now. So I think what those secret Facebook groups do is they at least help people to gain access to this information in ways that they otherwise like might not care about. Like if it's a union flyer, they're going to throw it away. If it's a union rep talking about something that they might not like fully understand, they'll maybe half listen or say like, I don't really have time right now. So I think it's a good initial like starting tool to help connect people at first, but then you have to use like your traditional organizing steps and go deeper. And that's why what we've been pushing right now is we want folks to see their school as their local, that the further you dig, the closer you get to the fact that your immediate workplace is where you have to organize and be organized at all times, that you can do these things simultaneously, that you can have this statewide connection to a Facebook group that connects you with people all across your state and especially in your county, but you can also use that information to connect with your coworkers.
It's been a year since the strike when we first talked. Has all the attention put onto the area changed the perception within the wider public and community on the strike itself? Is it still widely positive? And how is the strike looked back on?
It depends on, obviously it depends on who you ask.
Right.
But I think there are a few different ways of looking at it. So there was this candidate in Southern West Virginia, Richard Ojeda, who, he was running for the House of Representatives in Southern West Virginia. And he was very well liked in his district, especially during the walkouts, because he spoke plainly. He said, these are the issues. He tried to harness a lot, I think, in some ways of like what Bernie Sanders did when he came to West Virginia, to harness like the sort of resentment that West Virginians have against any type of, you know, established politician. And when the walkouts ended, he tried to continue to build that type of persona of, I'm just like you all. I wear work boots instead of dress shoes. You know, I live in the same neighborhoods that you all do. I'm working to fight for you because I'm not bought by these corporations.
And he was originally a Trump supporter and he voted for Trump.
Yeah. That was one of the things that they were sort of tying around his neck, was when he lost his congressional race, he got really upset at Trump because Trump had put out a lot of ads for his opponent, Carol Miller, who won. And so he got really upset and decided he was going to run a campaign for president for like 2.5 months before dropping out. And it was an attack against Trump, really. So they hung that around his neck, as a, you know, someone who voted for Trump. But, he was someone who tried to like harness this energy and push it for an electoral campaign. And when that crashed and burned, he was very upset by it. And I think there were a lot of people in our state who, especially the Democrats, who tried to harness the walkouts and use them to further, like, their electoral campaigns, to further their elections. And in some cases it worked. Some, like, really awful Republicans were knocked out, but there wasn't enough of a momentum in West Virginia, and certainly not in, like, Kentucky, Oklahoma, or Arizona, where, you know, they also had their walkouts, to really change the, like, electoral landscape at all. And so I think that the folks who had their hopes set around, like, using this as a way to push for elections were, like, disappointed and didn't want to relive another walkout. But for the people who felt like, no, this is independent of an election, this is independent of trying to get one party elected, we felt like, you know, it didn't matter who was in power. We were still going to do this regardless of who got in, you know, the legislature. So, right before the walkouts, actually, I was actually talking with some parents who were worried about the threat of another walkout, who said, I don't want, you know, there to be another walkout. I don't want my kid missing school. I think their fear was they didn't know how long this one would take. Mm-hmm. Because the last one lasted 9 days, and every single day there was this stressful moment, like at 8 or 9 o'clock, like, is my kid going to go to school tomorrow or not? And for a lot of parents, you know, without steady childcare, that's a legitimate concern. But I think when they saw that our focus wasn't on material benefits for us, that we were willing to give up a pay raise, that we were willing to give up additional funding for, like, our schools in ways that would actually help us as teachers, to stop charter schools and vouchers and savings accounts, that we were doing this for their kids. And we saw, like, an immediate shift, that there were tons of people who ended up actually supporting us, like, when the walkout actually was called. I think that dynamic had shifted and people realized that this was something that needed to be done.
Do you feel the teachers have gained more confidence to organize and fight back since the first big strike a year ago?
I do. I think a lot of the teachers that we met, like, our caucus was actually started by folks who just, we all met up because of the walkouts. We would see folks posting on the page who seemed more radical and more in line with our style of organizing. And so we'd reach out and say, hey, you know, are you interested in joining this group? You know, what skills do you have? What would you like to help contribute to? And when we met with our, like, other fellow teachers in our schools after the first walkouts, and we saw that their first reaction when we came back was, we should have stayed out. We should have stayed out until our health insurance was fixed, or I think we're going to do this again next year. I mean, they were saying this, like, March of last year. They're like, well, get, you know, keep your signs, because I don't think things are going to change quickly.
Right.
And when the business unions were saying, like, well, let's lobby the House of Delegates, because I think we have more friends there, or I think we can knock off a few senators to stop this really bad bill from going through. There were enough teachers who, on the page and in our schools, were saying, that isn't going to work. Like, we've tried this before. We've done this enough times. And the only thing that stopped it was a strike. And they said, we have to be willing to at least threaten one to show that we can't let them pass this really awful bill. And I think that had it not been for the organizing that occurred during the last walkout and after the last walkout to build up to this, I think we wouldn't have had the time to organize any type of really good resistance to what we saw.
Subvert, and the people all subvert, subvert, subvert.
Have the official unions changed at all since the strike, either in terms of action or how they attempt to talk to workers?
That's a funny question, because as one of the organizers I talked to said, like, as soon as we launched our caucus, he said, no union wants to have a rank-and-file caucus in their membership because they know the ultimate goal is to try to eventually, like, knock off leadership and to replace them because the role of the caucuses are always at least to build power until you can, you know, grasp power. And we're still actually having discussions about that as to, you know, what does power look like for us? Is power independent of them? Is it in the chairs calling the shots? Like, what does it look like? But when the West Virginia Education Association had their annual delegate assembly. They have these every year in Charleston. Last year's delegate assembly, they had very uplifting speeches. People were very, you know, praiseworthy of their unions, but they instituted this rule where you couldn't record anything, you couldn't videotape, and the executive director, David Haney, actually, I think, said, the year before, they had been infiltrated by, like, Russian bots spreading disinformation. And the funny thing is, they were talking about me. Because the year before, when I had attended the delegate assembly, I wrote about how, these conservative teachers unions needed to actually start going back to their roots, you know, after Trump got elected and assumed office in 2017, I said, look, the conservative way of doing things isn't going to cut it. We need to go back to the basics. We need direct action. And it wasn't very flattering to them. They eventually found it and got really mad. And they called me out, though not by name there. And afterwards, we just kind of had a laugh, like, wow, I think they're really scared. Like, they didn't want to talk about the Wildcat. They didn't want to talk about the Facebook page. You know, they were honestly, I think, scared of what was happening. So, over the summer, the National Education Association had a gathering of teacher groups all across the country where they had these walkouts. I think it was at Harvard, and they wanted to have, like, this symposium. You know, what do these walkouts mean for the NEA? And all the teachers' unions in the different states brought at least, like, one rank-and-file teacher that could represent, like, the independent groups that started, except for WVEA. They brought a superintendent who wasn't very friendly to the walkouts. Wow. Yeah. And they brought someone who was, like, I can't remember who it was, but they were kind of disconnected from the struggle. They were just, like, union-picked. And we knew, like, as soon as that happened, like, all right, they're not going to play ball with us. So when we announce as a caucus, they're going to be really mad. And they were. They never really said directly to us that we don't like what you're doing. But when the talk of strikes started to heat up in like early February, late January, I think, the American Federation of Teachers, AFT here in West Virginia, started putting out like emails and like flyers, things like that, saying, you know, don't trust, I think it was like third party media platforms. Don't trust like third party groups that might be trying to dissuade you of what union leadership says. We represent your best interests, so trust us. We have your, you know, we have your best interests in mind. And we always knew that every time they would talk about that, they were talking about us. It was the Facebook group or it was the caucus.
Very much builds off the classic, the Reds are out there, don't trust them.
Yeah, it's funny you mentioned that because we had someone actually in our caucus temporarily who ended up ratting us out to AFT leadership. He took screenshots of some of our conversations online and was sharing it around with AFT leadership. And right before the walkouts actually happened, he was getting into fights. This guy who was trying to like spread disinformation about us, he was trying to spread this, you know, this he was using these Red Scare tactics online. He was saying like, listen, we're here to make schools better. We're not here for a worldwide revolution or for some larger socialist aims. We're just here to make our schools better. And we knew he was talking about us because he had taken some screenshots and knew how radical we were and knew, you know, some of the things we said that we didn't want others to know about. But the funny thing was, as much as he kept like red baiting and pushing this issue, like he posted this thing about how, if you've seen like the pamphlet DSA put out, like why socialists should be teachers, the introduction said it was written by teachers in West Virginia. And he was saying, all right, who did this? You know, which idiot did this? And as much as he tried to like red bait, no one really seemed to care, which I thought was interesting. So The word socialist was actually brought up a bunch of times by people who didn't like us either in union leadership or by Republican legislators. And as much as they kept bringing that up, no one really seemed to take the bait, which I thought was kind of fascinating.
The other side of that is that there's a larger system that they are protecting and trying to expand. It's not like they don't have a worldview that they are protecting at all.
Yeah, absolutely. I don't think that they're, you know, throwing that word out there just because they, you know, think it'll gain them some political points. I think they see in some way sort of the writing on the wall. The senator actually who put forth this really awful bill, Patricia Rucker, she's actually from Venezuela, and she wrote an article. Yeah, the story goes deeper. She wrote an article right before the new year about how West Virginia shouldn't be a socialist country or a socialist state like Venezuela, and she knew how bad Venezuela was because she used to live there, and she lived there before the Bolivarian Revolution and how wonderful it was. And then she was lucky enough to make it to the United States before Chavez took over because she saw how bad it was, and she was afraid it was going to happen to West Virginia if there were more taxes. And it was, you know, you could tell like that was going to be their line of attack. And every single time they did it, it actually allowed us the opportunity to actually say, well, actually, this is what socialism is. It gave us the inroads to talk about, no, like, socialism isn't just taxing, you know, these corporations more. We want to do that, but that's not socialism. It's worker control. And, you know, as the strike progressed, like, right now, what I'm actually seeing online is people are actually taking this idea of workers in schools having a say in how schools are managed and run and connected to the community. People are actually seeing that as a legitimate option instead of this neoliberal reform view of education. And I think that's actually one of the bright sides of what happened is they red baited so much that it forced the conversation to talk about socialism, to talk about worker control in ways that they didn't fully think they could control after that. And right. we were able to step in.
That's interesting. You brought it up, but we're going to now talk about the legislation that politicians tried to pass targeting teachers, which is in response to the strikes in 2018.
Yeah. So the bill that was put forth was called the it was the omnibus bill. It was all these things thrown in together, SB 451. And the number was always, you know, we could always remember it because it was reminiscent of Fahrenheit 451. So we always said, like, instead of burning books, they're trying to, you know, burn knowledge. So, you know, it was a very easy bill number to remember. You luckily don't get that a lot, but anyway, so what had happened was in December, the Speaker of the House, Mitch Carmichael, replaced the education chair with Patricia Rucker, the, you know, woman from Venezuela. And we started doing a little digging. Patricia Rucker's background was actually, she said she fled Western Maryland, like Montgomery County, that she called like a socialist county, socialist Maryland, I guess, you know, to good old conservative West Virginia. And she claimed to be a teacher, but we found through like a little bit of Freedom of Information request, she was actually never a certified teacher in Maryland or West Virginia. So she had done like some subbing work, but then she became a homeschool advocate. And then when the Tea Party movement was becoming popular, she helped organize Tea Party groups in the Eastern Panhandle before she became a senator. Well, as soon as he appointed her to the Education Committee, we knew, like, all right, they're gunning to do something awful for education to sort of retaliate against us. We didn't fully know what it was, but in January, we started seeing, like, the Chamber of Commerce in our state and the Cardinal Institute, which is like a Koch brother funded think tank. They started putting out like, hey, did you know West Virginia doesn't have charter schools? Did you know West Virginia ranks like 48th in terms of school choice? Isn't that awful? Shouldn't all students have choice? And we figured, all right, well, this is going to be their game. Like, they're going to push for charters this year and they're going to push it heavily. And, as soon as the session began, they, created this bill, SB 451, that would have given teachers another 5% raise. It would have provided additional funding for school counselors, I believe, in the original bill. But it also had retaliatory measures as well. So they said you would start with unlimited charters. So anyone could start a charter school. There were no caps. There were no requirements. It was just a free-for-all. They would just open up West Virginia immediately. They had educational savings accounts, which are like kind of like vouchers where if you are a parent and you don't want to send your kid to a public school and you want to send them to like a private school nearby, they would give you the money, like a percentage of the money that you would, you know, be giving out in tax dollars basically to the public school, and it would just divert it to the private school. So they wanted to open it up to that. They wanted to do, like payroll protection. So if you were a union member, you had to like re-sign up members, and like get all their information again. So it was like a union busting tactic, and they were going to eliminate seniority, as one of the features. Like whenever you're a teacher, if you're transferred, if your position's cut, they always go, you know, by a set rule. And one of those things is seniority. They were going to cut that. So it would allow certain counties that are cash strapped to immediately fire the teachers who've been there like 20, 30 years, close to retirement, who will make a lot more money, and just hire a bunch of like new teachers. And they put this forth, they discussed it for maybe like a week before they voted it out. And as soon as they voted it out, teachers in Mingo County had a vote of authorization and said, like, if this thing goes any further, we're going to go on strike. And that was reminiscent of what happened last year. And as the bill progressed, it finally made it to the House, and they tinkered with it a little bit. And eventually what they came up with was what they thought was a good compromise. They'd say, okay, you can only have two charter schools in West Virginia, and you have to have like a majority of parents, teachers, and the Board of Education, I think, have to vote to approve it. They eliminated savings accounts. They didn't affect seniority or anything like that. And they said, all right, this is a good enough bill. Like, we can live with this. And so AFT was pushing for people to call their legislators and, like, vote for this new bill, like, this new version, because they said, like, there's no way charters are going to come in. Like, the way it was written, it should be fine. And people were actually furious. They were like, well, wait a minute. We've been spending all of our time trying to organize against this bill. We had walk-ins the day the legislature began in like 20 counties and said, like, we need to focus on mental health counselors. We're a state that has like one of the highest rates of opiate addictions, one of the highest rates of grandparents raising their kids. Like, there are systemic issues that affect education. Like, that's why we have to spend more to help our kids. And we said, no, like, none of this helps us. None of this, like, answers any of the things we brought up. And we kept pushing and said, no, this is a bad bill. We have to strike over this bill regardless. And eventually the bill made it back to the Senate, and they did their tinkering again and said, all right, we're going to put back charter schools. They put in 7 charter schools, like 1,000 savings accounts, and said, you know, we think this is now our compromise. And it was actually that day that they voted on it that our union said, all right, we're going to walk out tomorrow. We want to make it clear, like, even if it dies in the House of Delegates, we want to make it clear that this is a bad bill. We cannot allow charters. We can't allow privatization. We can't allow savings accounts. This will gut public education. And that was sort of like the buildup to, like, why we went on strike.
What was the process like for that mobilization after people came to the realization that that's what needed to be done?
It varied from county to county. One of the things we learned, actually, because we were all like watching what happened in L.A., in Denver, right before we went on strike too. One of the things we noticed in LA that was really helpful for them was putting up signs in like local businesses that said, like, we support our public schools, we support our teachers, things like that. So we wanted to make it clear to our communities, like, in late January and early February, that if this thing progressed any further, they might have to endure another strike. And we wanted to let them know, like, this is what is wrong with this bill. So we went to our communities, we put up flyers that said, we support our public schools. We held informational pickets where we would hold up signs, we'd hand out literature, letting people know, like, this is what charter schools are. This is why they're dangerous. They're going to call it school choice, but it's not school choice. It just, you know, the rich kids are going to be the ones who get to go to these new schools. And I think, like, by doing this community organizing at the same time, we were able to, like, show the parents who were fearful of another walkout that, you know, if this happens again, they're doing it because they absolutely have to, that they're really here to protect our kids. It's not for, like, they're not striking for their own material benefits. It is to protect our kids. We actually, like, one of the benefits of our caucus was we were able to connect with teachers across the country who would send us, like, solidarity videos. And we had Rebecca Gorelli from Arizona. I can't remember, her video now has like over 100,000 views, I think, something like that. And she outlines, like, in like 5-6 minutes, like, here's what charters are, here's what savings accounts are, here's how it's decimated Arizona schools. You can't let them get their foot in the door, because if you think you're safe, the minute you allow them in, you can't shut that door. And I think it allowed people to see that this is a struggle that we need to be engaged in. And if we're going to be successful, we have to be united again. And I think that, like, that online, on the ground campaign that helped us organize teachers last year helped us organize in our communities this year.
Can you talk a little bit about your experiences during the strike?
Yeah, the unions held a vote of authorization like, I want to say like 2 weeks before we actually went on strike. And they called a strike at like 6:30 that night for the next day. And the funny thing was, like, we kind of immediately knew, like, from last year, we had to have a connection with our, like, superintendents to let them know, like, you have to call off school. You have to have a snow day. And so people were told, like, depending on the county you're in, you had to, like, mass call off. And then the superintendents would know, okay, here's my justification why we can't have school. We just don't have enough staff. And so they would just close school for the day because of the work stoppage. And then once you had that, we all sort of immediately just decided en masse in our counties, okay, here's where we need to picket. So because we went on strike last year, we kind of knew here were the best places to go picket. You know, we tended not to be like right out in front of our schools. If we could be somewhere that was like more higher traffic, we went there. The difference was like this time around, we didn't have as much time to organize like food drives, to send food home for kids. We didn't have like the preparation work. So we weren't able to get that side organized as quickly, but luckily we didn't have to, you know, focus on it as much because it only lasted 2 days. So as soon as we were out, we were pretty much right back in. The only real difference I think this year was in Putnam County, which is right next to where our capital is. They actually stayed open. They were the only county to stay open this time around. And we're actually kind of learning from what happened in Putnam County, and we're going to be try to like use it as an organizing tactic for the future. So Putnam County decided they were going to stay open. And as soon as they decided that, local counties like nearby all decided, okay, when can you be on the picket line here in our county? Can you head over to their county and shut them down? And so you had people from all the surrounding counties and nearby actually flooding to their county to help shut them, you know, shut it down. And the bus drivers were actually the ones who helped ensure that, you know, there are actually very few students who attended schools because they decided they weren't going to have the buses run. And people were picketing in front of the bus garages, not letting them run. And that pretty much shut down most of the county. But what had happened was in schools where people were very well organized, they had really good building reps, they had on-the-ground support, they had been, like, prepared for the possibility of a walkout, only, like, maybe two or three teachers crossed the picket line. You know, so parents realize, I'm not going to send my kids to school today. It's not worth it. They're not going to, you know, they're not going to learn anything. But schools where they were disorganized or they didn't have a good building rep or no one really told them, like, you know, prepare for this. This is a possibility. Like, you need to have communication with your coworkers to tell them not to come to work. In those schools, we saw, like, 40 or 50% even of people crossing picket lines there. And that showed us that, you know, we know some of the counties where superintendents were hesitant to close. They felt like they had to. But if we ever have to go on strike again, you know, if this becomes an annual thing, we go out next year, we have to make sure that folks realize, like, this is how you organize in your school. This is how you build power locally. And this is how you, like, protect yourself should they keep the schools open and should there be like threats of injunctions against you. Initially, some of us were frustrated that we had gone back so soon. There was still the possibility that they could amend one of the bills and put in charters, and our health insurance had never been fixed. So we were still hesitant in some ways to go back so quickly, but in hindsight, now that it's been, you know, almost a week since we went back, I think it was actually it was a success in that we stopped a well-funded, well-oiled privatization machine in their tracks. And to my knowledge, that's not really ever happened. You know, you can stop the expansion of charters like in LA or in Chicago in 2012. But once they're there, you can't really, I mean, you can organize to stop them from expanding, but you can't strike to remove them. And I think what was successful was we were able to mobilize and really educate people about what charter schools are and how they're connected to these outside donors, especially like ALEC and their well-funded machine. And very quickly, we were able to get people across the state educated on what that was. So even if our health insurance isn't fixed, even if our pay increase doesn't go through this session, I think it's a success in that we learned a lot about what does organizing look like a year after a major strike, and then you have to do it again. But it also teaches us that for so long, I think we had to be on the defensive because our unions had become complacent. They had become just lobbying arms for the Democrats, especially in our state, that they weren't really seen as effective fighting tools to actually put forth legislation or to put forth an idea of, like, this is what we're fighting for. We're not just fighting against something. So this round, we felt we were fighting a defensive battle against privatization. And what we learned is over the spring and summer and into fall, what we need to do is start organizing in favor of certain legislation. We want to push for schools that are better funded, that have a revenue source that is, you know, through progressive taxation, that are more connected to the communities that we serve, that have an understanding that the systemic issues facing our students have to be reckoned with, and that the notion that you can just, you know, tie the quality of our state's education system to tests is just, you know, laughable because of what we're facing. So I think going forward, we're going to take a more proactive approach and try to focus on our understanding of social justice unionism and connecting our unions more to our communities and putting forth proposals and ideas that we think would better serve our state.
Inspiration through the workers, what you run. There will be no power greater anywhere beneath the sun. Cause what force on earth is weaker than the feeble strength of one? But the union makes us strong. Because we hold nothing in common with the greedy parasite who would beat us into serfdom and would crush us with his might. At this point, there's nothing left for us but to organize and fight. Cause the union makes us strong. Cause it's we who plowed the prairies, built the cities where they trade, dug the mines and worked the factories, endless miles of rural late. Now we stand a casting star amid the wonders that we made. The union makes us strong. Build it skyward stone by stone. Hell yeah, you know it's ours, not to slave him but to own. Cause the union makes us strong. Now they have stolen us for millions that they never worked to earn. But without our brain and muscle, not a single wheel can turn. We can smash their fucking power, take our freedom when we learn. The union makes us strong. Cause in our hands we have a power greater than the holy gold, greater than the strength of armies multiplied a thousandfold. We can bring to birth a new world from the ashes of the old, while the union makes us strong.
Now that the strike is over, would you view it as a success, something that went halfway, or something that at least was able to block the proposed legislation?
In some ways, it's kind of a... some of the struggles have been sort of cautionary tales as to, like, what happens if you try to bottle lightning and redirect it, that it loses its efficacy, right? So right now, with the presidential campaign sort of heating up, I know Bernie Sanders came out and tweeted out like support for Oakland teachers. And I think there's this desire to take what is sort of like an organic struggle and use it for these campaigns that feel very disconnected, or at least like it can sap the energy of them. Because if we see our struggle for better schools, and we connect that struggle to the larger class struggle and the larger labor struggle, that can't so narrowly be defined, obviously, by a political party or, you know, a presidential candidate or any candidate for that matter. And I think there's this, like, this innate feeling of once you've done something like this, that's it. That the way to sort of build power after that is to redirect it towards the, old modes of organizing, that you've won this massive strike, that you've built this, at least, you know, level of class consciousness, that people do see their material needs not being met by the system. And so you try to redirect it in some ways to, elections or lobbying or, you know, something like that. And I think the danger is when we do that, the people that we've helped to build up along this path then see that struggle in more of a narrow lens, because they see it attached now to a candidate or a party, even though it never really originated there. And when that system of elections or the candidate or whatever fails it, people become obviously more disenchanted with a struggle and they fall off. And I think right now, the biggest thing, the worst thing I think that can happen to this struggle, if we're looking at the teacher struggle as a larger labor struggle, is to try to divert that energy back to elections, back to a presidential candidate. You know, it has to be independent of it. And if those candidates or those parties want to adopt the facade, I guess, of, you know, trying to build that power, you know, we can't stop them. And of course they're going to do it because it might, you know, it's popular for them in the moment. We understand that. But I think the people who are like working to help build that power can't be sucked into like the desire to be part of this, the system that we know is already corrupting. So being able to continue to build that power independent of those structures, I think, will be important if we're going to see this labor struggle continue.
Do you have any insights on that? That seems to be the million-dollar question, right?
Well, yeah. So in West Virginia, I think I mentioned it before, maybe last year, we were lucky enough to be, and I say this, you know, loosely, we were lucky enough to be a blue state until like 2014. And what I mean by that is like, we've seen that the Democrats and Republicans are pretty much like one and the same in our state. They're pretty much run by the same interests. They're going to do the exact same thing. The only difference is, what's the facade? Like, are they going to, you know, put the veneer of progressivism, or are they going to put the veneer of conservatism? That's it. So what I've tried to like help people understand is you can see some, you can see Democrats in a lot of ways as allies. And I know, like, in our House of Delegates and in our state Senate, we have allies who will put forth legislation on our behalf that are, like, very beneficial to our schools. There's no doubt about it. But at the same time, we can't, I mean, we have to recognize that if the Democrats flip the House or the Senate or the governor's mansion here in West Virginia, or, you know, if you take this and make it national, that you're going to still be fighting the same struggles. And so you can't ever become too attached to this notion that the allies that you've built up in election are going to be there afterwards, because the goal, obviously we know this, but the goal once you're elected immediately shifts to remaining in power, and the people who got you there aren't going to be the power behind it once you're there. So what I've tried to get, like, my fellow caucus members to realize is, you can love the Democrats in your district. You can love how progressive you are. And, you know, if you want to vote for them, or if you want to campaign for them, okay, you know, you do that if you feel that's what is needed. But know that that is the lowest bar into, like, political organizing. And I think by expanding, like, that definition of what it means to organize politically beyond the electoral sphere will be important going forward. So, you know, recognizing that who is your class enemy? It's going to be the Democrats, it's going to be the Republicans, it's going to be anyone who holds those positions of power, as long as those positions of power have power over us. So trying to steer clear of, you know, having that desire for the immediate reward, the immediate, like, I'm part of this campaign, I'm a campaign manager, I'm helping with this candidate, and maybe I'll get a position later, you know, recognizing that that's not what is going to get you those goals, is yeah. helpful.
One of the most important aspects of the struggle is how people pushed back against DNC and union bureaucrats, although now it seems that unions are adjusting their strategy. How do you think this will continue to play out over the coming terrain?
Unlike in what happened in Chicago, like in 2012, with their strike, they had built their independent power in spite of the inefficiencies of their union. And over time, through building that independent power, they could take over leadership and then prepare for a strike. And what we're noticing is every other state now has kind of done it the exact opposite way, that we were building this independent power and then immediately had to go on strike. And then we had to build power yet again. We're still not the ones calling the shots, but we are pushing the unions to do things that at least make it appear like they are on our side. And I think the most difficult challenge right now is, if you're going to engage in this type of organizing in teachers' unions, it's a good entry to connecting with the struggle of labor writ large, but you're obviously always confined to where you're at, how good your building reps are, how good your local leadership is. And I think when we try to, organize in this fashion, trying to build the independent power that leads up to, a force that pushes union leadership to actually take action, you can build from that. None of the teachers' unions in any of the states that we've looked at really felt comfortable with going on strike last year. They did it because they felt they had no other option. It was, you go on strike or you lose membership. And because in, I think, all the states that had major statewide walkouts, their right to work, if people could drop union membership immediately without any, you know, need to be in a union for a job. So the unions recognized they had a need to actually listen to membership when it got that bad. But after their walkouts occurred, they felt they could just say, well, let's go back to the way that we've done it because we got that out of our system. We think it worked and now we don't want to have to use that again. I think what we need to see is maybe the reverse. Instead of like building up independent powers to take power and then use direct action, we need to have actions that precipitate taking power to allow this struggle to help bring in more people. And I think Virginia actually is kind of an interesting case study there. The Virginia Educators United group that started and was sort of like the impetus for their, I think it was January 28th, March on Richmond. None of the teachers unions really wanted, the VEA, I don't think they really wanted to have this action. But the Virginia Educators United wanted it to go through. They recognized that even though the governor was a Democrat, even though the legislature there, I think, is split like 50-50, that there nothing was really going to get done, that it had to be from them. And I think at this point, in order to like sort of maintain your independence, being able to go back to what we saw last year, building this power that is semi-autonomous from your union leadership, but still within the confines of the union, allows enough people to participate in it so that you're bringing in folks who otherwise wouldn't be radicalized through this sort of independent organizing outside of a, you know, outside of an established union. And once you can bring them into that sphere, you can help to push them to actions that they, you know, otherwise wouldn't be comfortable with. And so they do take the day off and they do rally at the Capitol and they do march with other people. And then that action pushes them further. And then once they've had that experience, they're going to help spread it. So right now to summarize, like to push forward, there needs to be those independent powers that are building within every state's or major cities like union leadership that can push them to action and then can maintain that level of organization after that action and show this is why it was successful and this is why we have to keep building this power like this because this is the only thing that's going to give us what we need.
Thank you so much for taking the time to talk with us and look back over the past year. Anything now that you're working on that you want to plug?
Well, I'm working with a fellow IWW member in Oklahoma. She's a professor out there. We're working on a book actually on the walkouts. We're going to examine them actually through the lens of intersectionality, solidarity, unionism. And I think what's going to be interesting is Eric Blanc, who's been writing for Jacobin for some time now about these walkouts, his book's actually coming out in April, and it will be interesting to see sort of the juxtaposition between his takeaway from the walkouts and the Red State Rebellions, what it means for the labor union, and where our work will come in as, you know, a year after the walkouts. What do they mean for people there? Has there been organizing? And if not, what are the limitations of these struggles? And we are hopefully going to have that out by the end of 2019.
Awesome. We look forward to it. Hey, take care and thanks again.
All right. Thanks for having me.
This has been the It's Going Down podcast. Check itsgoingdown.org for daily updates, columns, action reports, and news. Go to itsgoingdown.org/shop to support us and follow us on all social media platforms. IGD, your daily resource for insurgent proletarian life.